Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Professor Daniel R. Schwartz. Schwartz is a professor of English and a Stephen H. Weiss Presidential Fellow at Cornell University, where he has taught since 1968. He received Cornell's College of Arts and Sciences Russell Award for Distinguished Teaching in 1998. Schwartz is the author of many articles, poems, and books, including the highly regarded and widely read Imagining the Holocaust, which we're going to discuss this evening. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Nice to see you, Tish.
Before we get into the specifics about literature, let's talk about the premise of Imagining the Holocaust. In the beginning, you asked the question, what is the role of literary imagination in keeping the memory of the Holocaust alive for our culture? Can we answer that?
Well, the point of my book is to argue for the importance of imagination in transmuting fact into literature, and to argue that acts of imagination are more powerful and compelling than simple statements of facts. Mm-hmm. We imagine through art. There is a strong distinction between what happened and how we remember what happened, and a strong distinction between how we remember what happened and how we tell an event. So I have stressed in my writing how we make sense of our lives by ordering them and giving them shape. Mm-hmm. Such narratives, even when they're memoirs or diaries, have an aspect of constructions. Mm-hmm. So I talk about how narratives about of the Holocaust, beginning with first-person reminiscences, such as Wiesel's Night.
Yes, and that's what I want to start talking about. Yeah, let's talk about Wiesel's Night. It's become somewhat controversial, although he called it autobiography, and you call it fictionalized memoir.
Wiesel is a good friend of mine, but we have some difference here. Wiesel feels that it gives support to Holocaust deniers to admit that there is some difference between what happened and how we remember what happened, and a difference between how we remember what happened and how we speak about it. Mm-hmm. I think a case can be made for stressing how powerful his work is, and yet saying that it's an artistic construction.
Mm-hmm. It's an amazing book. It really is. But let's talk a little bit about what it's about. It's about a little boy who essentially loses his faith.
Well, it's about a 15-year-old boy who loses his faith and somewhat falls into what we might be called despair, and who at the end somewhat emerges from that, but without full religious faith. Mm-hmm. There are other versions of this which support the point that it's an artistic construction. Supposedly in South America, 700 pages of notes there's a somewhat longer version in Polish, which has been translated. Hmm. And then finally, there's his own version that he wrote in France to get it published. And he wrote it under the auspices and support of the French intellectual Mauriac.
Yeah, that's the version I actually read.
Right.
Yeah.
There is now a new version, which I haven't yet read. But in the new version, he acknowledges something that I pointed out, namely that it would be impossible to be 15 for more than a year.
But is that a huge point? I've heard other people dispute that, and so what in some ways? Well, so he was 16, right?
Well, I think he was 15 part of it, 16 part of it, and mm-hmm. probably 14 part of it. Mm-hmm. No, it isn't a huge point. And in fact, he and I have discussed this personally. And in this exchange of letters, it doesn't indict the book at all.
Right.
But it acknowledges that our memories are faulty. It shows mm-hmm. that imagination selects and arranges, gives an ethical shape, mm-hmm. And provides the passion that makes living reality of events. Mm-hmm. I mean, the reason his book is so great, the reason we call it a masterwork, is that it speaks to my view that imagination is necessary to get the truth and experience of those millions who perished. There's a there's a tremendous difference between 700 pages of notes and this very short, spare, sparse eloquent narrative.
Incredibly poetic, yeah. Too. You know, one thing you brought up is that in the Yiddish version, he seemed to carry more of an indictment for the world's silence than he did in the French version. What are the disparities in the different languages? Was he involved in the translations?
He actually was living in Paris, and the French version, which was then translated into English, was his. The English translation was not his. Mm-hmm. What he's done now, apparently, is his current wife has translated this new version, in which he is a little bit more careful about historical facts. To call Knight as a fictionalized autobiographical memoir,
that's what you called it,
is what I do, mm-hmm. is simply to follow the distinctions I'm stressing, that when you write about what happened in the past, you're imposing a kind of order on events. Autobiography is not stenography. And when we write, we impose a different reality from the originating events. The best example of that is that if you and I walk outside here and talk about what happened during this interview, we would see that no two people ever tell the same event the same way. Mm-hmm. So his insistence that there's like a master telling, like there's only one way to see mm-hmm. events, is a little bit naive. And
so,
I think
so
he knows
saying,
that.
Are you saying, though, that there's no such thing really as autobiography?
I'm saying that autobiography is an art form. And yes, there's autobiography. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But I'm saying that each autobiography renders a particular version of events.
Rendering
the story of the same event, whether it's trivial or of earth-shaking importance, mm-hmm. are going to render it different. I mean, that's why we have divorce court.
We don't have a lot of time to discuss all this literature, but let's move on to Anne Frank.
Okay.
Because she's a sort of a complicated subject, in my estimation. Talk to us a little bit about her place in this talk about literature and the Holocaust.
I would say, I would make it back up just a moment. I start my book with first-person reminiscences and highlight really three. Mm-hmm. Wiesel's Knight, Primo Levi's right. work, which the mm-hmm. most important of which is Survival at Auschwitz, but all of his books, and The Diary of Anne Frank. Mm-hmm. And I think I do want to make the point that diaries and autobiographies are constructions, they are narratives, they're ways of telling, and they engage imagination. Mm-hmm. It's imagination plus passion plus facts that make a compelling narrative. Mm-hmm. And I want to say that. And I want to make one more point about Knight before we leave it.
Okay.
In comparison to Levy, Knight kind of sanitizes Wiesel's own behavior. He does not admit the moral ambiguity of his behavior. He points to the moral ambiguity of other people's behavior in relationship to their fathers, although he certainly feels great guilt for finally leaving his father. Levy talks much more about how one has to steal food, that if one person gets us privilege, somebody else doesn't. He's mm-hmm. much more interested in the economy of personal relations in this heightened, despairing, awful circumstance. Mm-hmm. So I would mm-hmm. say, not to be jargony, but it's a much thicker reader of what it actually takes to survive. Mm-hmm. To survive means to steal. To survive means to hustle. To survive means sometimes to connive. And Levy understands that's what people do. And survive means, and one of the big factors in survival is luck. So I think we need to stress that that's another possible criticism of Wiesel. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Okay. I always think of Wiesel as it's sort of an autobiographical poem in some way. So I sort of gave him poetic license as some of the controversy started rising up, I must say.
Well, I think that's right. And I think nothing that I write in any way diminishes its stature. It is mm-hmm. a poem. And Knight yeah. is a central image. Knight comes to be moral darkness, spiritual darkness, historical outrage, loss of faith, mm-hmm. Even the darkness of an empty stomach. It becomes a kind of moral vacuum. Darkness becomes equated with emptiness. So you're absolutely mm-hmm. right. It is mm-hmm. a poem, and nothing that I say should in any way indict its importance. Mm-hmm.
So, right. so let's, can we move on to Anne Frank now?
Yes,
so
we just
we'll
did.
Have time to talk about her. Yeah. Let's talk about the diary and the Broadway version and the sanitizing that Otto Frank did. And so what is her place in all this?
Well, I think, again, one can have text that one criticizes and still recognize its wonderfulness. And Frank, like Wiesel, speaks to an historical reality, namely the systematic attempt to destroy all European Jewry, which began in the last week of June 1941 with the German invasion of the Soviet Union, but actually the seeds were laid as early as 1933. Frank's book, which originally was published in Holland with the titled The House, translated as The House Behind, mm-hmm. and then that was the English translation. And it's probably the best known and most widely read Holocaust diary memoir. Otto Frank has somewhat sanitized it. He's taken out a certain amount of pubescent sexuality and a certain amount of harsh comments about the mother and possibly mm-hmm. even the father.
But I also heard that he minimized Anne's Jewish faith, especially in the Broadway version.
Well, he had nothing to do with that. That was mm. that was a play that was written later. I mm. mean, he you're right. He approved that. There was another version of it by Meyer Levin, mm. and he liked the more what might be called the middle class maturity version of Anne Frank, but that was really not his doing. That was the doing of the people of a group of people who wanted to produce it to on Broadway and produce it for an audience that they thought this was before the Holocaust industry that might find it appealing.
Yeah,
and certainly it was edited. In a way that left out some of the harshness of personal relationships, but certainly the diary did. The play also played down the Nazi presence, and actually a newer version of the play, which was produced in a number of places, including Ithaca, about 6 or 8 years ago, stresses the Nazi presence, and the prefatory. There was a preface by Eleanor Roosevelt in the 1952 English edition, and the emphasis was on seeing this as a diary of a young girl's maturation, and the translation was also in idiomatic English.
Seems awfully strange that they would have to sanitize somebody in this way to get sympathy,
well,
perhaps.
We need to back up a little mm-hmm. bit. Historically, the Holocaust was not foregrounded after the war. People didn't even use mm-hmm. the term survivors. They used the term refugees. The Americans were very embarrassed by not having done more to save more people. Mm-hmm. You know, the jurist stories of turning back the ship St. Louis were there, and only a handful of Jews were let in during the war. The Jewish establishment was disappointed for not doing more. The Americans knew what was going on by 1942. So there was a kind of conspiracy of silence about this subject. When I was growing up, it was not spoken about in public school or, interestingly enough, in Hebrew school, where I went 3 days a week to a conservative synagogue. So that when this was, it was really a diary which did have some historical context. It did make people who were unaware, of which there are a great many in Topeka, Kansas, or Omaha, Nebraska, aware of what was going on.
Right, right.
It brought into the classroom this girl's search for self-definition, a search for intimacy, but also the reality of what it was to be enclosed. So while some people would like to have more historical perspective, after all, she's enclosed in a room and is looking out with her eyes. She doesn't see the panorama of Europe, mm-hmm. but she certainly shows us how a life is kind of bisected and made more and more claustrophobic.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that her line, "I still believe in spite of everything that people are truly good at heart," is the one that survived instead of some of the lines that she said that she could see the world being slowly transformed into a wilderness and so on. I mean, those aren't lines that stay in our imaginations.
Well, that was part of the kind of liberal humanistic ethos.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and my guest is Daniel Schwartz. We are discussing his book, Imagining the Holocaust. Do you want to continue your thought about Anne Frank and some of the lines that have
Well, it is, it's been objected. You mentioned that the later dramatization of the diary by Albert Hackett and his wife Frances Goodrich turns Anne into an even more representative figure of Western humanism that ignores her Jewishness. But I think Anne Frank's perspective in Holland in the 40s during the war was typical of assimilated Jews. She didn't speak with a Jewish accent. She did not mix bits of Hebrew in her discourse, but this is the way people talk. I mean, we have to remember, Frank, in fact, was originally a German Jew,
right.
And these people, and up until the American Jews of the 20th century, were among, and even the later 20th century, were among the most assimilated Jews in history.
Mm-hmm.
And Anne Frank was not part of the Satmar sect in Williamsburg.
Right. I still think she lasts as a good symbol. When I was living in the Netherlands for 3 years, and
right.
A lot of people made fun of Anne Frank as the big symbol of the Holocaust. They thought it was a shallow rendering. But I still think it's amazingly touching and human for her to be the symbol myself.
I think it's
made a lot of change and so on.
Well, I think it was one of the ways consciousness was raised in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
It shows us that Jews alone were marked out to be destroyed in their entirety. How every Jewish man, woman, and child was marked mm-hmm. in once the Nazis took over. And also, you know, we read a book like Anne Frank with our historical knowledge. We know that Anne Frank died in Bergen-Belsen. So
right.
You have a sense that we understand an historical context that gives it meaning. She
yeah.
died a few weeks before
yeah.
liberation.
And the thought that she would, if she were alive today, would only be 77 years old just shows you how recent this was.
That's a very good point.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But I think that the very fact that she's talking about a humanity that's obliterated,
mm-hmm.
makes this quite a compelling book, even now.
I agree.
And there have
mm-hmm.
been, I should say, and you alluded to it, there have been additions made since the 1952 edition, and there may be further ones. The Frank, there's a Frank authority in Holland
right.
that's
mm-hmm.
sort of an offspring of her father's work, and they're very protective of her.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been a book by a woman named Mueller, who talks about some of the things that are left out, and one can piece together. And yet these things are not very important, really.
Yeah, But you must have visited her house in Amsterdam, too. It's such an amazing feeling to visit, I think. I visited it twice.
Well, I actually visited when it was just a house and they hadn't made it into
a
historical
memorial.
Place.
Yeah.
I visited it in 62 and it just was barely wrecked. It was her house and you could walk through it. And then I visited since then when it's become really something of a Holocaust memorial.
Yeah, it has. Yeah. But I thought it was very effective. It's incredibly sad. Let's move on. We don't have hundreds of minutes left. Schindler's List is another book. You say that you thought the book was good, but the film was absolutely magnificent.
Well, there are people who have quarreled with Schindler's List as a great Holocaust film, but I happen to think it is. I think it's a great film because it encapsulates the major historical themes. We see the Jews gradually deprived of rights. We see them entering the ghetto. We see their struggles with hunger there. We see brutalization. And finally, we see the smoke, really, which reminds us of the ashes on the car of Schindler. And finally, we're actually inside in Auschwitz. So I think that this is a great film which really speaks to the major themes and brings it to people's attention.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, millions of people saw this film. just like the green television show, which you mentioned, the Holocaust
series.
Yeah, the series, which had a great deal of opens people's eyes in an earlier time. This was really an important event in understanding the Holocaust. I mean, the Holocaust has gradually been foregrounded, not merely as a topic, but has become a field.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had written this book in 1968 as a way of getting tenure, I would have not gotten tenure, and it would have been the passport to obscurity. People didn't talk about these kind of things.
Yeah,
so I think that Spiegelman's has taken a pretty good book. Not a great book. I mean, Schindler's List, and made it a really by Keneally, but made it a splendid film and a memorable film. Mm-hmm. And I watch it and I'm just stunned by its efficacy.
Yeah. Did you think a lot of people wouldn't take the book seriously because it wasn't written by a Jew?
Well, that's a question we haven't discussed yet. Mm-hmm. Can great Holocaust literature be written by a non-Jew? And I think the answer is, of course, yes. Just like women can write about men and men can write about women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's obviously, we are all have our own perspective depending on who we are. But part of what we're talking about, part of his imagination is a writer entering the minds of other figures and trying to imagine how they behave and creating a affix or so that the reader joins with them, so that there's a kind of bridge between the author's imagination and the reader's imagination.
And I do think his book is incredibly effective. I've read the book and seen the film several times, and I thought the book was great.
I think the book is very good. It is not great writing. I mean, his unit is not the phrase like Wolf or Joyce. His unit is not the paragraph like
Wiesel's.
Right. Now, Wiesel, that's right. The kind of the poetry we talked about with Wiesel is really not there. But Spielberg saw that the book could be dramatized cinematically. He saw the visual potential in it. And that's why it made a great film from a good book.
And his choice to use black and white was absolutely stunningly perfect, I think.
I think that's right. Spielberg is wonderful, as we know, using cinematic devices.
But sometimes I think he's melodramatic. I don't think his work with The Color Purple worked, but that's another subject. I was afraid he was going to over-dramatize and make us weep instead of let us see the thing and decide for ourselves,
Well, I think that's right. I think that, but here he uses that black and white to give a sense of a newsreel or a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Good Night and Good Luck is very indebted to
absolutely,
that, by the way.
Absolutely.
But he really, and this is a better film than Good Night and Good Luck.
But yeah, it is.
He makes a historical fable. I think that's what we need to remember about the film. The film is based on the novel, but it's a mythopoeic fable of the Holocaust, using as its sources existing images, many of which are in the consciousness of people who know about the Holocaust. He even uses that color red, actually, comes from image in Wiesel's sister of his Wiesel's night, his sister. Was a well-groomed girl of seven with a red coat over her arm.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, he's drawing upon other themes or topics in Holocaust literature, and it becomes almost an encyclopedia of prior films about the Holocaust and books about the Holocaust, including Shoah.
And it's also an incredible story about Schindler himself. You know, this man went from a schemer and a profiteer to a very moral man who took this incredible moral stand. So it's a human story as well, which is compelling to people.
Well, I think what's interesting is that Schindler kind of reverted a bit to his prior behavior after the war. He didn't become a Nazi, but this man found his historical moment. There's no question about that. And you're right. The film even emphasizes more than the book how Schindler is a dandy, a decadent, and a refuge from the Vienna cabaret world, wearing a Nazi pin.
Right.
And obviously the conversion of somebody bad to good is kind of melodramatic. But melodrama can be efficacious.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. And I think we need some melodrama because the Holocaust is so unbelievable to so many people. Like you mentioned in your book, a lot of people, I forget which author it was, who said it felt like a dream The whole thing just felt like a dream to him. I forget who it was.
Well, Levy actually likes that. But other people use that image a little bit. But you're absolutely right. Levy in particular uses that.
We still have a few minutes left. Do you want to talk about Mouse?
Sure.
Art Spiegelman's incredible, brilliant cartoon rendition of the Holocaust. Well, talk to us about it.
Well, Mouse really shows us how imagination can work. One of the things that happens in this field is how people take umbrage almost at anything that's new in the field. And people at first were disgusted by some people, by the characters Jews being rendered as mice. But by using cartoons figures to present the Shoah, Spiegelman creates a kind of wildly inventive cosmos that invites us to look at the major topics of the Holocaust from a radically different perspective. And part of what he does is he turns the Jews, the cartoons about Jews, upside down. In some ways, Mouse is about the history of cartoons. The way the Jews were depicted in Der Sturm, one of the most influential newspapers of the day, and in other magazines, was to depict them with tails, with horns. So what he's doing, depicting the Jews as mice,
and the Nazis were cats.
Right.
To remind our audience.
But he's also emphasizing their position as others, consigned to live apart in cells, or in his terms, in mouse holes. Mm-hmm. And as Spiegelman depicts the mice in bed or at dinner, we become acquainted to them and accustomed to them as illuminating distortions. What he does is really, what these cartoons are illuminating distortions, that is, that enable us to see exactly how the Germans regarded the Jews and what it is to be in an kind of inferior position. Mm-hmm. And if you read the text carefully, you see that there's a degree of mouseness. At first, there are times more mice and less mice, depending on their particular situation. Gradually, we accept that these mice with human features, except for tails, which are totally hidden by clothes, think, feel, and love as if they were humans, just as Jews, who are called vermin in the Nazi era, think, feel, and love like humans.
Yeah, and in the beginning of his first books, Spiegelman said that Hitler's quote, you know, the Jews are undoubtedly a race, but they are not human.
And
this was his answer to that. I wanted to ask you one more question. The more time that passes and the more survivors who die year after year, do you think there is anything but literature and art that can keep this history alive?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think the further we get from survivors, the more that die, the less we rely on personal reminiscences, the more we are relying on passionate recreations, imaginative recreations, that we won't have any more personal testimony or reminiscences or autobiographies. These people, they're still being produced, but and there's the Holocaust Project. But the Mouse, which I think probably would have been justifiably criticized if it had been published in 1946, now seems like a very apt way. I mean, for one thing, graphic comedies speak to the younger people, and I think films like The Pianist, the films like Life is Beautiful, which I think is defensible, give us a different kind of sense, a more pluralistic, maybe what we called earlier in our conversation, a thicker reading of the Holocaust.
We have run out of time. Daniel Schwartz, thank you so much for being with us. Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.